This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start here in Boston, a community still reeling from the news yesterday that Monica Cannon Grant, a well-known activist and organizer, has been indicted along with her husband for alleged misuse of money raised by the nonprofit she founded, Violence in Boston. Cannon Grant first started gaining attention in 2017 when she organized a march from Roxbury to Boston Common in response to what was titled a, quote, free speech rally being held on the Common in the wake of the now infamous Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville that attracted white supremacists and led to violence and death. In the years since, she and Violence in Boston have grown in influence, acclaim, funding, and I want to acknowledge right at the top, that includes us having her as a guest here on Radio Boston a number of times, including featuring her on our Martin Luther King Jr. Day show last year. Here to talk more about Cannon Grant's impact on Boston and what this indictment means for our community, Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker. Adrian, I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Adrian, I'm just going to stress right up front here again at this point, these are simply allegations. It's an indictment. And of course, Monica Cannon Grant and her husband are considered innocent until proven guilty. So with that in mind, you wrote about this yesterday. How big a deal is this indictment here in the city?
Oh, it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal because she's become such an important, influential figure, as you noted at the top. And it's important, I believe, because it's going to reverberate for other nonprofits as well.
So let's take both of those pieces. First, how did she become such an important and influential figure over these last 5 years?
Well, you know, as you noted, it began sort of with the march in 2017, although she had been active before that. And, you know, she became known as a person who was a really authentic voice of the community. And it really took off with the pandemic, you know, when the pandemic began. She did a really great job of going out and really supporting low-income families, including, you know, raising money to feed thousands of people whose jobs is shut down as a result of the lockdown.
Yeah, the estimate was 1,000 meals a day, at least.
Yes.
At the height. So were there concerns along the way, or was there controversy? She wasn't without controversy.
She was absolutely not without controversy. She was an avid user of Facebook Live, which she often used to blast, you know, all sorts of adversaries, some of whom probably hadn't done much to deserve it. And I think, you know, she had admirers, but she had detractors, and she had people who were just afraid of her, too, you know.
So I want to pick up on this reverberation idea. You used it here with me a minute ago, Adrian. You used it in your column. Let's talk about the reverberations of this indictment. And I will start with questions about lack of oversight or transparency that you raise in your column.
Yeah, I mean, look, all of a sudden, all sorts of money was flowing to Violence in Boston, okay? A lot of influential people were helping to raise money. It became a cause everybody wanted to be associated with. And, you know, nobody really knew what kind of oversight or controls there were. And here we are now with this indictment alleging that, you know, some of that money at least did not go to the things it was devoted to. And I think it's fair to say, I know for a fact it's fair to say, that there were people who were always concerned that, you know, she didn't have any experience dealing with large amounts of money and that nobody was really in charge of making sure things were happening the way they were supposed to happen.
So I want to note, you know, I've run a number of nonprofit organizations in my career. I'm very familiar with the scrutiny that funders often do put in place, especially with younger or newer organizations, to make sure, you know, there's strong fiscal management in place, that those management skills are developing alongside the advocacy and leadership skills that founders often have. You raised in your opinion, your column, Adrian, this idea about, wait, where was the board? And of course, structurally, legally, the governing board has a fiduciary obligation, right? A fiscal responsibility to track the finances. Do you expect to see more examination there, you know, more questioning and comment about the governance, the people who were supposed to be watching the leadership?
I think there will absolutely be more questions about the governance. And I think there's bluntly no sign that they were doing anything. I mean, according to the indictment, and again, yes, they are just allegations. I mean, she was getting money and just signing it over to herself and depositing it in her own checking account. And who were the people who were supposed to be saying, you can't do that? Where was the treasurer?
So one of the things that you raise that is a sticky and uncomfortable question in this particular situation, Adrian, is the fact that when people did over the last few years raise concerns about stewardship, you know, is the skill set in place for management, et cetera, there were accusations that those were sexist claims, that those were racist claims, that they were discriminatory claims. We do know, again, coming out of the nonprofit sector, there's a long history in the donor class of being concerned that people who have experienced marginalization and vulnerability don't know how to handle money. That is a trope. So what do we do now with this tension, Adrian?
Well, I think this is a really critical question. But I think one of the lessons here is that, uncomfortable as those questions are, suspending oversight is not the answer. And I think that's what happened here. You know, I think that, you know, the questions that kind of got shut down about violence in Boston bluntly were fair questions that needed answers and still need answers. And I think, you know, there has been a tension, certainly between the donor class and nonprofits and allegations of racism, sexism, paternalism, you name it. You know, many of them well-founded, but just walking away from oversight does not work.
So one of the things that was intriguing, let's pick up the last piece here, that was intriguing to us about your column was your concern that this is going to, regardless of how this plays out, we'll say one more time, these are indictments, not a conviction. You're concerned that this now makes it harder for other organizations on the ground, grassroots organizations, startup organizations, et cetera, to get money, be trusted, find the finances that they need. Talk about that a little bit.
One of the lessons here, I believe, for donors is going to be that they gave $1 million to somebody without asking a lot of questions or without really knowing, you know, whether this was a good thing to do. And I think that other nonprofits, especially smaller nonprofits, newer nonprofits, are going to face a lot of these questions. How do we know we can trust you? How do we know what you're going to do with our money? You know, and I think bluntly, in the case of violence in Boston, in some cases, people didn't want to know. They wanted the affiliation. They wanted the association. But, you know, now there's going to be a lot more questions about where is the money going and how do we know?
So you made reference to $1 million. There were a wide range of gifts from different kinds of organizations. Some of these big, you know, at least one big seven-figure multi-year gift. There's been a lot of reporting about the fact that the Suffolk County DA's office made a $6,000 gift that the indictment suggests was ill-used, right? Not used for those purposes, but for a vacation
yes.
Instead. We find this interesting situation where Rachel Rollins is now the U.S. attorney, has to recuse herself from this. Are you hearing reverberations, you know, in the greater Boston community, concerns that others will get caught up in this mix and what that might mean, reputationally, practically, et cetera?
It's entirely possible, especially reputationally. I mean, I think there's more investigating to be done here and a lot more accounting to be done. And yeah, I think that people who have given her money are going to face some questions too.
So, Adrian, I have a couple of other subjects I'd love to bring up with you because I know you follow them closely. Can we move on a little bit? Do you mind?
Absolutely.
Great. So one of the things, I want to talk about the city of Boston. It is spring. The sun is out. Lots of news that is not COVID at this point. One of the things that we are watching are these two big searches that are underway in the city proper. There's the superintendent of schools search. There's the police commissioner search. You wrote not that long ago about the superintendent search. You've watched that what's happened with the police commissioner very closely over the last, you know, year or so. So I want to ask you, are you tracking these? And what do you make of the progress so far? Let's start with the superintendent of schools.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm watching them. And of course, the superintendent of schools search is in its very early stages. But yeah, I'm definitely watching to see what's going on with it. And, you know, I think that what the mayor really wants is somebody who will be really good operationally. I think she thinks the BPS simply does not run very well. So it'll be very interesting to see what the pool of applicants and what the pool of finalists looks like, you know, a couple of months from now.
So we know several major cities around the country, other school districts also, you know, there's a fixed pool, a lot of competitors in the search. We know the city is hoping to have somebody in place for the fall. I got to tell you, as an outside observer, that feels like a tight timeline. Do you think the city can hit it?
I think it's a very tight timeline. And I don't know if they can hit it. I mean, here we are in mid-March. They would need to hire somebody by probably July 1st, maybe, to have someone in place for the beginning of school. I don't know whether they can do that. We'll see.
And how are you, what are you thinking about with the police commissioner search, which is now underway as well?
The police commissioner search is also in a really interesting place. From what I understand, they're not really quite at the point yet, at least as of last I knew, as of a week or so ago, of actual applicants. They're doing a lot of being out in the community and listening to people in terms of what they want in a new police commissioner and what they think the BPD needs. And I think that's really smart. The timeline there is tight too, but it's more flexible. I mean, in the case of the schools, there's a big reason to want somebody at the beginning of the school year. You know, if the police commissioner search, which is supposed to be done by June 1st, goes on into mid-July or something, that's fine.
Okay, last question for you. Boston City Council is considering this ordinance proposed by Mayor Michelle Wu to restrict protests outside private residences. That's really mostly focused on the time frame. Hotly contested at a hearing on Monday. Do you have a prediction on where this one comes out?
I think it will pass, although I think it'll be a relatively close vote. And personally, I think it's a good idea.
All right. Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker, it is always great to have you, and today's no exception. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.